Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about records that Dionne Warwick made with Burt Bacharach, and then an interview with the Pogues making their classic album Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash, and a classic album review of the Beastie Boys, Check Your Head. We begin with the article about Dionne Warwick titled Make the Music Play. The exquisite records Dionne Warwick made with Burt Bacharach and Hal David set a bar for pop sophistication that may never be topped. Leaping across boundaries of genre and race in an era of segregation. But when Ritz followed hits, she proved she could go it alone too. I had all these voices asking, what's she going to do now she doesn't have Burt and Hal? She tells David Hutchins, I just said, this is what I'm going to do. April 28, 1963. Backstage at Paris's Olympia Theater, Dionne Warwick was doing her best to remain calm. Waiting to perform at Les Idoles des Jeunes, she'd met the Revue's local stars, Frances Hardy and Sylvie Vartan, and said hello to fellow imports, the Shirelles, and a 13-year-old Stevie Wonder. After recent months on the Chitlin circuit in the still-segregated southern U.S., her European debut promised a glimpse of another side of life. She took to the stage, however, to applause that quickly gave way to silence. From the cover of Warwick's latest French release, This Empty Place, featuring a barefoot strawberry blonde in a coquettish pose, they were expecting something or someone rather different. There was an audible gasp when I walked on stage, Warwick recalls. They didn't believe I was Dionne Warwick, which is why the first words she said on stage in Europe were, yeah, I ain't no white woman, I'm black. The singer, who turned 84 in December, is walking Mojo through a career whose milestones include sessions for Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, at the dawn of soul, reshaping the Philadelphia sound with Tom Bell in the 1970s, conquering the planet with Barry Gibb in the 1980s, and raising millions for AIDS research, towering musically above even those moments, though, are the hits she made with Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Walk On By, You'll Never Get to Heaven, If You Break My Heart, and Reach Out for Me in 1964 alone. That brought an imitable uptown sophistication to pop between 1962 and 1971. The only woman who had more American chart action in the second half of the 20th century was Aretha Franklin, a bet with the help of another song written by Bacharach and David and already released by Warwick, I Say a Little Prayer. And here's a little bit of that song, I Say a Little Prayer, by Dionne Warwick.
Mm-hmm. The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk comb in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you.
Forever, forever, you'll stay in my heart.
Run for the bus, dear. While riding, I think of us, dear. I say a little prayer for you. At work, I just take time.
It's a wintry New Jersey lunchtime, not a million miles from the home in which Marie Dionne Warwick, blame a record company, admit error for her professional surname, grew up. She was raised in East Orange, a few miles northwest of Newark and within easy reach of New York. Her father, Mansell, was a Pullman porter, then butcher, accountant, music executive, and road manager. Her mom, Lee, worked too, but also sang and managed the family gospel group, the Drinkard Jubilars, alongside her sister Emily, later known as Sissy Houston, and mother of Whitney Houston. Following suit, in 1957, Lee's daughters Dion and Deliah, aka Dee Dee, formed the Gospelaires. Gospel had always been the music foundation in our family, says Warwick, but we listened to secular music too, and I've never faced any problems for singing both. My parents considered music to be just music, regardless of genre. As a teenager, Warwick would venture into Harlem and the Apollo Theater, a venue the Drinkard Jubilars frequently played. Eventually, the Gospelaires, featuring Dion and Dee Dee, Sylvia Shemuel, and future soul star Doris Troy, plucked up the courage to participate in one of its notorious amateur nights. I'd seen Sandman Sims, the stage manager, drag acts off stage with his hook, she remembers. So it was terrifying, but we won, and the crowd at the Apollo accepted us. We thought we'd got it made. They weren't far wrong. In the Apollo audience that night was a scout from Herman Lebinski's Savoy Records, a label based in Newark, who asked the young women if they could add vocals at sessions for saxophonist Sam the Man Taylor. They can be clearly heard on 1961 single Deliver Me and blues singer Nappy Brown. We were just in the right place at the right time, says Warwick, doing these basic oohs, ahs, and ya-yas for Savoy. And a couple of weeks after that, I got a call from Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. One of the musicians at Savoy told them they should see us. Would we be interested in doing a background session with the Drifters? Warwick smiles all the way. Things just fell into place. Well, why not? It was at one of those sessions the Drifters were recording Mexican Divorce that Warwick first met Burt Bacharach, the song's co-writer and arranger, who was conducting for producer Lieber and Stoller. Bacharach, who had recently paired up with lyricist Hal David, was looking for a voice. He approached me to see if I'd be interested in doing demonstration records of the songs he'd write with David, recalls Warwick, and I said, as long as it doesn't interfere with my education, my mother would kill me, and you if it does. By day, Warwick was studying music education at Hart College in Connecticut. By night, she became the demo queen at the Brill Building, the office at 1619 Broadway, that was home to a host of young writing teams. Her versatility bringing out the best in any song looking for a singer. As the dominance of sheet music sales and Tin Pan Alley's Great American Songbook faded, the newcomers were willfully breaking the rules, adding jazz chord progressions to suburban pop melodies, pairing Neapolitan opera with rhythm and blues, melding unusual time changes to mambo and calypso, and creating music that teenagers of all colors wanted to buy on disc. At the heart of it was Florence Greenberg, a middle-aged white housewife who owned the Scepter and Juan labels and was responsible, along with her partner, Luther Dizon, for hits by the Shirelles, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, Chuck Jackson, Any Day Now, I Keep Forgettin', and Tommy Hart, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. Before the ascendancy of Motown and Stax, before James Brown got his brand new bag, this was one of the breeding grounds for soul. She was like a mother to us, recalls Warwick, a mother hen. She really was a loving, giving person and treated us like we were her children, and we enjoyed every minute. The first time Greenberg noticed Warwick was on a demo of It's Love That Really Counts, which would become a 1962 Shirelles single and later a Mercy Beat 45. Forget the song, she memorably ordered, get the girl singer. Greenberg offered the girl singer a recording contract. Bacharach and David presented her with a production deal. Having no dreams of becoming a star, Warwick handed the business side over to the one man she could trust. My daddy made sure the contract was correct, so I had no problems at all. Burt Bacharach and David had earmarked Make It Easy on Yourself for Warwick's first single, but again, Greenberg was unimpressed with the song. While Scepter dithered, Calvin Carter of VJ seized the opportunity to release a version by the former Impression Jerry Butler, which made the Billboard Top 20. Warwick had a bone to pick with the composers. They didn't keep their word, and I didn't like this too much, so I let them know, says Warwick today. I was furious and said to them, don't make me over, meaning don't make a promise you're not going to keep. And Hal David immediately went away and wrote, don't make me over, especially for me. I thought that was wonderful. I had solid evidence that they understood what I was saying, that this was the attitude I had to have. She laughs at the memory of a young and unexperienced singer being feisty enough to get her way. And here's a little bit of that song, Don't Make Me Over by Dionne Warwick.
Thank you.
take me over.
Now that I'd do anything for you.
Don't make me over.
Now that you know how I adore you.
Don't pick on the things I say, the things I do. Just love me with all my faults, the way that I love you. I'm begging you, don't make me over. Me over.
Once again, Greenberg detested the song. "We couldn't understand it," says Warwick. She, obviously, never had a good ear. We said we wanted it to be the single, and she looked at us. "No, I hate this." She made it the B-side of "I Smiled Yesterday." The biggest bomb I've ever had. More laughter. Thank goodness for DJs like Murray the K. They found the B-side and played it. Released in October 1962, "Don't Make Me Over" became not only the accidentally renamed Warwick's first hit, but the debut top 40 entry for Bacharach and David as writer-producers. The song would also serve as a template for the hits that followed. There's a dissonance between singer and lyrics. Despite laying down her ground rules, she's never in control of the emotions beneath the surface, and it flouted convection. The backing singers do most of the work for the first 40 seconds, building tension. Warwick is a model of detachment until, with less than a minute to go, both she and the orchestra crack. Almost immediately, as if playing hard to get, she vanishes, leaving Bacharach's orchestration to pick up the pieces. But just as you expect the tune to fade away, she returns, wailing the killer line, "Accept me for what I am, accept me for the things I do." Hal David was not a lyricist. He was a poet, Warwick says today. And Bert had a very unorthodox way of composing. However, he felt that particular day is how he would compose that day. Their compositions are not the easiest songs to sing, but because of my musical training, I had the ability to read music, and that's what I did. And I think that's one of the reasons the three of us got along so well. We were a triangular marriage that worked. Every time I went in the studio with Bert, he'd say, "Okay, let's see if she can do this." And when I did it, he'd say, okay, let's see if she can do this. Though it took a year to find a song that could build on "Don't Make Me Over" success, once the trio found their method, there was no stopping them. Anyone who had a heart took Warwick into the U.S. top 10 in 1963. "Walk On By" followed close behind it, while also, along with "Reach Out For Me," topping the R&B charts in 1964. Each one evades simple categorization. Definitely not easy listening, not textbook R&B, secular lyrics with a gospel feel. And here's a little bit of the song, Walk On by Dionne Warwick.
See me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet. Walk on by.
In April 1963, Warwick joined the Sam Cooke Show in Knoxville, Tennessee, for her first tour on a bill that included Solomon Burke, The Crystals, The Drifters, and Jerry Butler, plus Little Richard's former backing band, The Upsetters. "Oh, they upset me a lot," she squeals. Musicianship was not a priority at those shows. They'd tell me they could hear Bert's changes, not read them from the charts, just hear them. Whatever they were hearing was not what I was singing. But we got through it all. It was an education. Warwick had known Cooke since his days with the Soul Stirrers, the most famous of all the church-wrecking gospel groups, with whom the Drinkard Jubilars had toured. And unlike many of his early fans, she had not turned her back when he had become a pop star singing secular music. He was not a stranger at all, more like a relative, she smiles. He was a wonderful young man and an absolute gentleman, and he wouldn't allow me to come to the parties after the show or allow me to stay out late at night. Give me a break, and remember, my mommy was on the road with me too. I was captured. The tour was Warwick's first experience of the segregated South, of water fountains for black people, and having the police warn her about speaking out of turn. For Cooke, who would shortly after write "A Change Is Gonna Come," the most significant moment of the tour included water cannons being turned on African-American teenagers in Birmingham, Alabama, and intimidating police dogs patrolling the aisles of divided auditoriums. Undaunted, Warwick adapted the lyrics to showstopper "What I Say" for the occasion. "Tell your mama, tell your pa, we're going to integrate Arkansas." Staying on the road, she subsequently toured the U.S. again with Jackie Wilson. "He Spoiled Me Rotten" and made her European debut. In May 1964, she found herself on Ready, Steady, Go, her British TV debut. It was then she discovered that anyone who had a heart had been a huge UK success for Cilla Black, while her original had stalled in the lower reaching of the top 40. "I felt like I was still recording demonstration records for other singers. I hadn't a clue why they wanted to jump on my songs. Dusty Springfield did a credible job, but it was not only Dusty, it was Marianne Faithfull. It was, oh my goodness, the other girl's name, Sandy Shaw. You have some great writers, but we had so much great material, and it benefited Backrack and David more than me." Perhaps it was this discovery that made her take a closer interest in the business side of her career. By the late 1960s, Warwick had become part of the mainstream pop industry. Do You Know the Way to San Jose won a Grammy in 1969. Lifted from Bacharach and David's Broadway musical, Promises, Promises. I'll Never Fall in Love Again did the same 2 years later. Yet all was not well. Warwick had Scepter's accounts audited and announced she was leaving the label in 1971. After Bacharach and David scrutinized the books, Scepter collapsed. And here's a little bit of the song, Do You Know the Way to San Jose, from Dionne Warwick.
Parking cars and pumping gas. You can really breathe in San Jose. They've got a lot of space. There'll be a place where I can stay. I was born and raised in San Jose. I'm going back to find some peace of mind in San Jose. Fame and fortune is a magnet. It can pull you far away from home.
The trio's next stop couldn't have been bigger. Mo Osten called me personally and said, Warner Brothers wants the three of you. Please consider us. Wooed by a label renowned for valuing artist talent, Bacharach, David, and Warwick signed on as a team. Their next album, Dionne, released in 1972, wasn't a great success. However, with Bacharach and David preoccupied by their soundtrack to the doomed movie Lost Horizon, the pair fell out. Worse, it brought them into conflict with Warners, Osten, and Warwick. Lost Horizon, there's already a measure of distaste in Warwick's voice. That was something that should have been lost long before they thought about writing for it. They decided to split in the middle of our contract. Mo said they had to write my albums for me, so I would have to bring them back together, or he would sue me. Well, reuniting them was impossible, so I had to sue Bacharach and David for breach of contract, or Warners would take me to court. Heartbreaking? Yeah, but I had no choice. I was not going to be sued by a company as big as Warner's, nor did I deserve to be. That was the end of our relationship for 12 years, but I stayed friends with all Bert's wives, right down to Jane, the last one. They all loved me. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Warner's appeared reluctant to promote the four albums Warwick released without her former collaborators. I had all these voices asking, what's she going to do now? She doesn't have Bacharach and David. I just said, this is what I'm going to do. And I teamed up with Tom Bell and the Spinners to record Then Came You. Here's some of that song, Then Came You, by Dionne Warwick.
Since I met you, seems I can't forget you. The thought of you keeps running through the back of my mind.
every time I'm near you. I get that urge to feel you, just touching you and loving you makes everything right.
Tell me how you feel, baby.
Whenever you love before, then came you, then came you. I never knew love before, then came you, then came you.
Warwick's first Billboard number one was released in 1974, but on the Spinners label Atlantic, Warners wouldn't release Warwick's album of the same name until 9 months later. It limped to number 167 in the charts. Despondent, Warwick considered giving up singing and becoming a music teacher when her Warner's contract ended. She was saved by Clive Davis of Arista. He just said, "There's no reason you're not recording." I said, "I'd think about it." Then I asked God what I should do. I had found some great songs, and Clive had the idea of getting Barry Mandelow to produce me. I liked working with people I'd never worked with before, so... There's a satisfied pause as Warwick thinks back to 1979-1980. We won 2 Grammys that year, Best Pop Vocal Performance for I'll Never Love This Way Again, Best R&B Vocal Performance for Deja Vu, and Dion was my first platinum album. Here's a little bit of the song I'll Never Love This Way Again by Dionne Warwick.
Inside my fantasies and made each one come true. Something no one else had ever found a way to do. I've kept the memories one by one since you took me in. I know I'll never love this way again. Before the good is gone, I know I'll never love this way again. Hold on, hold on, hold on.
Greater success was to follow in 1982 when Davis paired her with Barry, Robin, and Maurice Gibb for the album Heartbreaker, which sold 3 million copies worldwide on the back of a title track that passed 4 million as a single. "It makes me feel good to know people appreciate me," she says. "That's the attitude I've had toward everybody I've worked with since Bacharach and David." While Warwick's stock had arguably never been higher, Bacharach had found it harder to keep his finger on the pulse of contemporary music. In 1984, TV producer Aaron Spelling commissioned him to write the theme song for TV drama series Finder of Lost Loves, but had specific terms. Aaron said, "Nobody's going to sing this song but Dion. So work it out," says Warwick. "Bert called me. He said, 'Hello, Dion. Who is this?' 'Bert.' I said, 'Bert who?' I did. Well, it could have been Bert Reynolds." Bacharach was summoned to an audience at which he apologized for the way their alliance had been dissolved. "Right there," he said, "it was the biggest mistake he ever made," said Warwick. Bridges repaired, Bacharach was also on board for That's What Friends Are For, a charity single recorded with pals Gladys Knight and Stevie Wonder, plus Elton John, whom she'd met in a supermarket the day before the recording session. The biggest selling single of 1986, it was Warwick's last chart topper. There have been gospel and Christmas releases since, but the final album of her Arista contract was a 1994 collection of Brazilian pop and samba songs sung in Portuguese. Here's part of the song, That's What Friends Are For, from Dionne Warwick.
And I never thought I'd feel this way. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad I got the chance to say that I do believe I love you. And if I should ever go away, well then close your eyes and try to feel the way we do today. And then if you can remember, keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for good times and bad times. I'll be on your side forevermore. That's what friends are for.
Although Warwick appears content to have spent much the past 30 years taking life as it comes, occasionally popping up on TV shows such as The Masked Singer or Celebrity Apprentice, and being one of social media's more universally admired contributors, her name has occasionally appeared in news headlines. There was a 2002 arrest for possession of marijuana, all charges were dropped, and bankruptcy in 2013, and she is today reluctant to discuss the death of Whitney Houston. When the American journalist Dan Rather asked her if she thought her cousin paid a price for her fame, she tellingly replied, "No, I'd say it was the price of the choices she made." Diplomatically, Warwick won't conclude by nominating a favorite song of by her most famous partners, but promises to sing plenty of them on her spring tour, which coincides with Songs of Inspiration, her first album in more than 5 years. "Being able to find great songs had a lot to do with my success," she says, "and I have always been completely involved with that. But when I didn't have Bert and Hal, I was inundated with songs. That's something I'm so very grateful for. It's always about great songs. They keep me alive." Okay, now I move on with to the article about the Pogues. And this is an interview with members of the Pogues. The Pogues, Unleash, Rum, Sodomy, and The Lash. Out of the saloon bars of early 80s North London came an unholy union of Irish rebel music and punk, fronted by hard-drinking poet-bard Shane McGowan. In 1985, the Pogues recorded their masterpiece of romanticism, defiance, and defeat with Elvis Costello at the controls. "It was suddenly like the songs sounded huge and full," recall the principals. "You'd have to say it was awe-inspiring." Shane McGowan: "The energy of punk rock was already in Irish music. When I was a kid, I saw the Dubliners, the Clancy Brothers. It was all around. The idea for the Pogues was just adding a bass guitar and a very loud drummer stood up in the middle. Mo Tucker style, except he was," clenches fist, "and Spider's drinks tray as well, a traditional Irish instrument, like the bones or the spoons." Live, Spider Stacy was wont to hit himself over the head with a drinks tray. Spider Stacy. I first met Shane when he was in the Nipple Erectors. You could hear that this guy was a really great tunesmith, and the lyrics were always smart and slightly psychotic. In early 81, Shane, myself, and members of my old band, the Midwall Chainsaws, played down at Richard Strange's Cabaret Futura as the New Republicans, doing Irish rebel songs, and that was the springboard for the Pogues. Shane had wide-reading empathy and a keen and observant eye, but the way he plunged into that whole Behan-esque Joycean literally tradition, you'd have to say it was awe-inspiring. Jim Finer. There was this period where it was just me and Shane practicing and going busking. When he started teaching me what would become Pogues music, I was quite blown away. It felt so familiar, the old already, but also so totally of that moment. Dave Robinson. I went to see them early on. They did two songs and dived into the audience, and only the drummer, Andrew Rankin, was left. I went into the public bar next door, and they were all in there having a pint. So I thought, these are my people. Their first manager, Stan Brennan, had produced 1984's debut, Red Roses for Me. So we signed that, and it sold about 4,000 copies over a few months. They were always so smashed out of their minds. It was very hard to get things going. They had a small, punky crowd. The Irish didn't like them because they were A, English, and B, too drunk even for Irish people. So we got them a tour with Elvis Costello, circa Goodbye Cruel World, and after that, they were starting to get wild audience participation. Spider. The drinking thing got rather overplayed. It was a recruitment motif, if you like. But we didn't drink any more than any other band. I mean, Jesus, have you ever met an orchestra? Jim F. Shane's writing was becoming more expansive. A Pair of Brown Eyes had actually been around since Shane and I were busking, as this song called Me and Hanley, about the Falklands Islands, an anti-Thatcher, anti-war song. The old main drag was also one of the first songs we did, but songs would change form or split apart, and one part would meet up with a bit of another song. In this long gestation, Sally McLennian, on the other hand, just arrived, fully formed. Shane would just come in and go, here's a song, kind of mind-blowing. Shane, I was reading a lot of history books. People used to know their own history, and my grandparents on both sides had fucking done their part in what is known as the Irish Revolution. So what? I've got to become a moron because I play in bands? James Fernley. For the Costello tour, our sound man, Daryl Hunt, made this mixtape of Irish traditions, and elements from those songs found their way into the second slew of material. Like I lifted an accordion part from Dermot O'Brien's Connemara Rose for a Pair of Brown Eyes, and we all thought it was really funny. Spider, there's been a perception in some quarters that the Pogues were a one-man band. That was really not the case at all. James Fernley has never had the credit he deserves for arranging the songs. You often had to coax songs out of Shane, and usually it was a cooperative effort. James F. There were many times when it ended up with Jim, Shane, and I in a rehearsal room. getting to the bottom of what Shane was trying to do, while everybody else went to the pub. We knocked heads a few times. Shane was a feisty fucker. I maybe saw more of his feisty side than the vulnerable, gentle side. But I was gobsmacked to find that he'd written Sally McLennan. I was ready to believe it was a traditional, just because of the subject matter of the pub, and saying goodbye to somebody, and the way that it sounded. It's a little bit of that song, Sally McLennan, by the Pogues.
Well, Jimmy Bright, I'm on again, the pub where I was born. He played it from the night time to the peace of early morn. He sold the souls of psychos and the men who had the horn. And they all looked very happy in the morning. But Jimmy didn't like his place in this world of ours. For the elephant man brought strawman's next and he had too many pairs. So I sat to see the grieving of the people that I'm leaving. And he took the road for God knows in the morning. We walked into the station in the rain. We kissed him as we put him on the train.
Jim F. For the Irish tunes we actually covered, Shane and I have these little books called Traditional Songs Popular in Ireland. Stuff like Eric Bugles and the band played Waltzing Matilda was in there, as was Ewan McCauley's Dirty Old Town, which we already knew from the Dubliners. David, after the Costello tour, I'd put the feelers out. Would Elvis produce them? He'd left Stiff and his manager, Jake Riviera. My ex-partner had him signed to his new label, F-Beat. So it was a delicate negotiation. As luck would have it, Elvis had the hots for Kate O'Rourkean, bassist. So he decided he would do it. Elvis Costello, I saw my task as to capture them in their dilapidated glory before a more professional producer fucked them up by taking away that raw thing they had on stage. James F. I was intimidated on the first day when he came down the stairs into the basement at Elephant Studios in Metropolitan Wharf. Rapping, there was Elvis with his pork pie hat on, peeling a pomelo, a fruit that actually rhymes with his name. By now, he was already living with Kate in Holland Park, hence the exotic fruit. It was a bit like, oh, we're West End people now, and you're still North Londoners. Jim F. Elvis was a massive step up from Stan. You felt you were in the hands of someone who knew what they were doing. It was suddenly like the songs sounded huge and full, reaching a potential. Elvis Costello. I know Shane didn't like me at all. I wasn't a punk. As far as he was concerned, I think he thought I was a dilettante. The music I'd made immediately before that wasn't my strongest game. So there was every reason. James F. There was this Ovation guitar Costello brought in, which Shane thought was bewitched or something. He projected whatever inner conflict he had about working with Elvis onto it. Here was a songwriter with a certain amount of power who was going out with Kate. When Shane and Kate had a relationship, and with Shane being a lightning conductor for emotions, that he wouldn't know what to do with apart from make them into a song or drink himself stupid. So he gave the guitar a kick and it went flying across the room. And we had to make sure that Elvis didn't know. Spider. The album title was drummer Andrew Rankin's idea. He had read that Winston Churchill was having an argument with some admiral, and Churchill said to him, "Oh, don't talk to me about the traditions of the Royal Navy. They're just rum, sodomy, and the lash." Perfect. Thematically, it's a combative record. A lot of it is to do with war, weaponry, and soldiers. Billy Bones is all about a soldier, the gentleman soldier, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, too. A Pair of Brown Eyes is all about military service and how people don't understand it now. And The Wild Cats of Killiney is about a fight. And here's a little bit of the song Billy's Bones by the Pogues.
Family. Hey, Billy son, where are you now? Don't you know that we need you now? We're at our town, the old cat's fell. Where are Billy John's resting now? Billy went away with a face-skin horse, cause he loves a bloody good fight at first. Went away in a big khaki van to the base of a Lee Jordan. Billy saw the arrows and he had him on the run when he got him in the range with some machine gun. Got the Israelis in his sights, we're at our town, they ran like shites. Hey, Billy son, where are you now? Don't you know that we need you now? We're at our town, the old cat's fell.
40 years later, Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash won't stay in its box. It wants to get out, which is why we're playing it again. Jim F. It's taken on a whole life of its own, and we've got guests appearing like Lisa O'Neill and guys from Lancome. It feels like how tradition is supposed to work. You take something from the past, then you rework and reconfigure it, and pass it on again. So playing these songs with this new generation who were inspired by us, it feels like a circle completing itself. Now it's time for the Classic Album Review, and this week it's Check Your Head by the Beastie Boys. The Beastie Boys were burnt after the meteoric rise of their culture breaker of a non-stereotype rap group and origin story, Licensed to Ill. The trio fled their home base of New York City and labeled Def Jam for the greener shores of Los Angeles and Capitol Records to have artistic control in the West Coast Sun on 1989's Paul's Boutique. An artistic breakthrough that was a commercial flop at the time, once Mike D, MCA, and Ad Rock hit the early 90s, they were beaten and nearly forgotten. So much so that Capitol Records didn't even communicate with them for a couple of years. The boys were no longer hot, so they smoked weed, played basketball, built a skateboard ramp, and ultimately familiarized themselves with their instruments once again at G Sun Studios in Atwater Village. Adam Horovitz's first outfit, The Young and the Useless, opened for Bad Brains at CBGB's in 1982, and it became that fire, that inspiration, a punk ethos that the group would revisit at their lowest point. Between the bong hits, three-pointers, and skin knees, the Beastie Boys found themselves again. The before hip-hop version was where they earned that initial street cred. As Ad Rock puts it in the documentary made by Apple TV, in the Beastie Boys story, 5 years earlier, we're at Madison Square Garden. Now we're playing clubs. You'd think we'd be bummed out about it, but actually, falling off can be fun. Check Your Head, released in April 1992, was their third album. And at the time of its release, to me, it sounded kind of mellow in context with the two previous releases. But 30 years later, it's smoking. They are rapping their asses off like never before, speaking with that freedom, vibing with a different type of bravado, letting cats know they got it, and a whole other thing too. Clocking in just under an hour, the collection of 20 songs resembles a Spotify playlist or mixtape. Sounds like three bands hijacked your backyard barbecue. On the 4th of July, one street punk outfit ready to fuck shit up and burn this mother down, Gratitude, Time for Living. One white boy hip-hop group rapping for their vegan dinner and a six-pack, So What You Want, and Jimmy James. and then an impromptu fuck trio who were really nice with the instruments and 70s blaxploitation musical cues, but would most definitely snatch your crate of records when nobody was looking. And here's a little bit of the song Jimmy James by the Beastie Boys from their album Check Your Head.
Song on our new album.
Had incubation schooling, time with elders of the craft around them from the start, Run DMC, LL Cool J, and most notably, Public Enemy. Second wave hip-hoppers luminaries, but more importantly, black men from New York City and the culture-making boroughs living in the race riot era of New York City, pre-Giuliani, mind you, forced to subscribe by a quality control code. Every day, if the Beasties were, let's say, a fake or Fugazi, those brothers would have kicked those cats to the curb from jump. Fortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine, a collaboration between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Also, a review about Questlove's documentary on Sly and the Family Stone. Classic album review of Nothing Like the Sun by Sting. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rockin'.